upset. Benson said he owed a huge debt of gratitude to the stubborn young TM enthusiasts who had come knocking at his door in 1968 for setting his career off on such a fascinating trajectory. But, like John, Paul, George and Ringo before him, the cardiologist was destined to fall out with the Maharishi. The TM movement, which was now becoming extremely wealthy in the US, began to fund its own research, eventually making this one of the most studied forms of meditation. Meanwhile, Benson and his team were finding preliminary evidence that the relaxation response can counteract the adverse clinical effects of stress in a wide range of disorders. He reeled off a long list to me. Hypertension, cardiac arrhythmia, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, all kinds of pain, headaches, premenstrual tension, inflammatory bowel disease. There was even evidence it could coax young college students into reducing their recreational drug use. Nonetheless, decades would pass before the medical establishment accepted the health benefits of a quasi-spiritual practice such as TM. For many years, like Newton's clandestine dabblings in alchemy, Benson was forced to pursue his meditation research quietly, in parallel to more conventional work. I had to conduct two careers at that time, one as a cardiologist and the other as my crazy thing, he said. At one point, he came close to being thrown out of Harvard Medical School because his boss thought it was unforgivable for a doctor to be wasting time on so-called hippie nonsense. Benson appealed to the dean, Robert Ebert, who put a stop to any talk of dismissal with the memorable phrase, "If Harvard can't take occasional chances, who can?" Some 55 years later, the relaxation response, elicited by mindfulness meditation and TM among many other techniques, has gone mainstream. A study published in the American Journal of Hypertension, for example, suggests that by reducing levels of psychological distress, TM can lower blood pressure in young people at risk of developing hypertension. And in 2013, the American Heart Association tentatively approved the use of a range of meditation techniques as complements to conventional antihypertensive treatments. Interrupting the train of regular thoughts, as Benson puts it, seems to be the universal key that unlocks the relaxation response, though it has remained something of a mystery how its beneficial clinical effects are mediated at the molecular level. Genetic research is now starting to provide some tantalizing clues. Already well into his eighth decade, Benson contributed to two studies published in 2008 and 2013 that revealed a wide range of changes in gene expression, the activity of particular genes, that are associated with the response. In the first study, his team compared gene expression across the entire genome in two groups of people, those who had no prior meditation experience, and those who had spent between 4 and 20 years practicing a technique known to elicit the response. The researchers gave the first group 8 weeks of relaxation response training, taking blood samples before and afterward to compare gene expression. Meditation in both groups appeared to suppress the long-term activity of genes involved in inflammation and stress responses, and crank up that of genes responsible for efficient energy metabolism, insulin secretion, and DNA repair. Some of the changes were more pronounced in people who had been practicing for years. In the second study, they found that many changes in gene expression were triggered extremely rapidly by meditation, showing up on tests immediately after a session. These activity levels were sustained or had even increased 50 minutes later, and were greatest among experienced meditators. Again, there was a boost in the expression of genes involved in energy metabolism, DNA repair and insulin secretion, and decreased expression of genes involved in inflammation and stress responses. Benson believes the relaxation response reduces oxidative stress at the cellular level and tames the inflammation associated with so many illnesses known to be exacerbated by chronic stress, including hypertension, anxiety, insomnia, diabetes, and rheumatoid arthritis. The overall pattern of genetic changes in experienced meditators seems to be the same regardless of the technique used, whether it's Qigong, mindfulness, TM, yoga, or repetitive prayer. The research also suggested that in the long term, the relaxation response may combat cell aging by promoting the repair and maintenance of the stretches of expendable DNA at the ends of chromosomes known as telomeres, which act like the stiff plastic sheaths that prevent the ends of shoelaces from fraying. In order to divide, a cell must duplicate all its chromosomes. But every time this happens, some of the DNA in its telomeres is lost. Eventually, in cells that have to divide many times in the course of a lifetime, the telomeres wear down to such an extent that the integrity of the genes carried by the chromosomes is threatened. To protect the body as a whole, these cells stop dividing and become senescent, and may eventually undergo apoptosis, cell suicide. So in most cells, the telomeres seem to act like lit fuses, steadily burning down until, bang, it's all over. Telomere length thus provides a measure of a cell's biological age, and, on average, people with shorter telomeres seem to have lower life expectancy. There is also solid evidence that working in a stressful environment shortens telomeres and accelerates aging. By promoting the activity of a gene that makes telomerase, the enzyme that rebuilds telomeres, the relaxation response may combat the effects of aging at the cellular level. Some very preliminary research even suggests that going on an intensive meditation retreat could slow this stress-related shortening of your telomeres by boosting telomerase activity. The snow-capped peaks and dense pine forests of the Colorado Rockies provide a stunning backdrop for meditation retreats at the remote Champala Mountain Center. For 3 months in 2007, this was the setting for a unique scientific experiment conducted by Tonya Jacobs of the Center for Mind and Brain at the University of California, Davis, and her colleagues. 60 men and women were randomly assigned to two groups. 30 of them stayed at the center, where they meditated for around 6 hours every day and received expert training in a variety of contemplative techniques. And 30 were put on a waiting list for the retreat. This second group of people, which was similar in terms of its male-female ratio and age profile, average body mass index, and prior meditation experience, carried on with their regular lives in the outside world and acted as controls for the experiment. At the end of the 3 months, blood samples were taken from both the experimental subjects and the controls at an on-site laboratory in the basement of the retreat center, so that the activity of the telomerase in their immune cells could be measured. Telomerase activity was found to be significantly higher in the people who had been on the retreat compared with the controls. The authors concede their study had some limitations. For example, the numbers of participants were relatively small, and it's hard to know whether the increased telomerase activity was a result of all the meditation they were doing, or simply because they had been removed from the stresses and strains of their everyday lives. A similar difference in enzyme activity might have been seen if half of the subjects had been sent to a sunny beach somewhere for a relaxing holiday. Participants filled out questionnaires before and after the retreat to gauge their levels of mindfulness and well-being, which did seem to indicate the increases in telomerase activity were mediated by improvements on these measures, but psychological questionnaires of this kind are notoriously unreliable. Nevertheless, combined with the evidence from genetic research, the study provides a tantalizing hint that the relaxation response, elicited by meditation, might slow cellular aging by ramping up the activity of telomerase. More research using active control groups, which pit the intervention being investigated against an equivalent activity, will be needed before doctors can recommend meditation as a way to keep the grim reaper at bay. What is certain is that the relaxation response evokes a blissful sense of tranquility. Benson argues that meditation achieves its stress-busting effects by interrupting the train of normal everyday thoughts. He believes that in the distant evolutionary past of our species, when our ancestors were living on the African savanna, we paid a high price for our increasingly sophisticated brains because we were now capable of thinking about the dangers that threatened our existence. So whereas creatures with less highly evolved cognitive powers were able to get on with foraging and feeding after the threat from a predator or rival had passed, humans didn't find it so easy. Their overactive imaginations kept their bodies primed for action, with all the damaging health effects this entailed. It's not just having a saber-toothed tiger in front of you, it's the thought of the saber-toothed tiger, Benson told me. It's the thought of someone or something injuring you that evokes the fight-or-flight response. This would seem to suggest that the downside of having evolved a bigger brain is chronic stress. But there was an antidote available to anyone fortunate enough to stumble across it, a mental trick that could be used to rapidly restore one's physiology to a more relaxed baseline state. The many side effects of stress include anxiety, depression, and anger, but people found by trial and error that if they adopted a certain posture or breathed in a certain way, they broke the train of everyday thought that was evoking the fight-or-flight response. And they felt good, said Benson. He believes the relaxation response is the foundation of all forms of meditation and the common thread that runs through many of the spiritual experiences described in the literature of the world's religions. The ancients were right. All we've done is put it in the language of the day. Science. His own outlook remains that of a scientist unaffiliated with any religion. The relaxation response, he told me firmly, is simply a way to temper the stress response. In fact, in the early years of his career, he was so anxious to maintain his objectivity, he didn't attempt to elicit the response himself. I was fearful of being accused of being a true believer. But now I'm older, and I need it. He sits down to meditate for 20 minutes twice a day before mealtimes. It seems the relaxation response is so natural that even the 8-year-old Prince Siddhartha managed to discover it for himself. The first step toward enlightenment is a calm mind, but it is only the beginning. There must have been more to his childhood experience, because as an adult, he would describe it succinctly as rapture and pleasure born from seclusion, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. This translation hints that there was also mindfulness, which is the focus for much of the rest of this book. An Indian ascetic living in the 5th century BCE wouldn't have raised an eyebrow at the mindfulness element of the experience, but rapture and pleasure was surely anathema. Nevertheless, the homeless Siddhartha reasoned that there was nothing wrong with enjoyment, even ecstasy, provided it had been uncoupled from the cravings of the body and the mind was firmly under control. Why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality, nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities? He thought. Was there a middle way between the extremes of self-denial and sensory indulgence? He knew he couldn't attain this happy, balanced state while his body was racked by hunger. One story has him taking his begging bowl to a nearby village, where a Brahmin girl offered him a meal of rice milk, and another villager gave him some kusha grass to use as a mat during his final effort to attain enlightenment. When they found out, his five followers were disgusted at these indulgences. "Gautama the Contemplative is living luxuriously," they exclaimed. "He has abandoned his exertion and is backsliding into abundance." They deserted him, believing he had already failed in his quest. But as evening turned to night, Siddhartha settled down to meditate cross-legged with his back to the fig tree and the setting sun. He vowed not to get up until he had realized his goal. "Let my skin and sinews and bones dry up together with all the flesh and blood of my body. I will not stir from this seat until I have attained the supreme and absolute wisdom." Guided meditation. Only the breath. It is in the nature of the mind to wander, which may be why we hardly ever notice it happening. By training yourself to focus on a simple, predictable, and repetitive stimulus, such as the breath or a mantra, and retrieving your attention whenever it strays from the chosen target, you become better at noticing. Think of meditation as a gentle workout for your brain's attention circuits. With practice, it will become easier, and you will be able to focus for longer and longer periods of time. Like any focused attention or concentration meditation, attending to the breath evokes the body's relaxation response by calming the mind and aligning it with what's happening in the present moment. Your only responsibility will be to concentrate on the sensation of each inhalation and exhalation, noting when your attention has wandered, which it will, and patiently returning it to the breath. That's it. Rather than striving to achieve a goal, which is what we spend most of our waking hours doing, consider this a welcome opportunity to stop and simply be. Make meditation as much a part of your daily routine as brushing your teeth. Set aside 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or half an hour, depending on your circumstances and experience. It doesn't really matter. The important thing is to practice regularly. Choose a quiet time when you are unlikely to be disturbed. Many people find first thing in the morning before breakfast works best. But if you find yourself struggling with drowsiness or hunger, try practicing after a light breakfast, sugar-free, to avoid ramping up your insulin levels, which will make you lethargic. Eventually, you should aim to practice sitting cross-legged on a cushion on the floor, which is the ideal posture for staying awake and alert. But if you are new to meditation or have a physical disability, a straight-backed chair is fine. Wear loose-fitting clothing that won't pinch or restrict the circulation. 5 minutes meditation is enough to start, but you can extend this as you become more skilled. Set the timer on your phone, selecting a gentle rather than a shrill alarm and turning off the vibration. Use the phone's silent or aircraft mode to avoid any electronic interruptions. Your posture should be erect and balanced, with your head, neck, and back aligned but not stiff. The aim is to be relaxed, alert, and dignified, reflecting your desired state of mind. Experiment until you find a position you can sustain comfortably. If you're in a chair, sit with your legs uncrossed and the soles of your feet flat on the floor. Take a few slow, deep breaths. Relax your shoulders and facial muscles. Notice the points of contact between your body and the floor, cushion, or chair. Now focus on the sensation of your breath at your nostrils as you breathe in and out. Don't try to control or change the breath in any way, merely observe it. When you realize that your mind has wandered from the breath and you have started planning, analyzing, or musing about something, note what has happened and gently escort your attention back to the breath. If the thought seems important or pressing, you can tell yourself, "I'll deal with that later." Remember, Everyone's mind wanders. Simply note what has happened without blaming yourself. Restrict your attention to each inhalation and exhalation as it comes, nothing more. If you find yourself speculating how long it will be before the alarm goes off, answer this thought with, "I'm only interested in this present moment of experience." Focusing on the breath is your only responsibility, so let go of everything else. If you are having trouble staying focused, use the mantra Buddho, knowing or conscious awareness. Say Bud during the inhalation, Do during the exhalation. Make the mantra fully conscious rather than an automatic repetition. Try visualizing the spelling as you say it. Alternatively, imagine a peaceful setting as you breathe in and out. It could be anywhere. You could be sitting near the mouth of a cave, halfway up a mountain, looking out at the blue sky through the opening as if the cave were the cavity of your own nose. You could be in a boat, sailing a straight course on a wide, calm lake, the gentle pressure exerted with a hand on the tiller representing the steady, sustained effort of focusing on your breath. When the alarm goes off, open your eyes, stretch, and give yourself a few moments. There's no hurry to get up. And remember, mindfulness is a state of attentiveness to the present moment you can bring to everything and anything you do. It's not just about meditation. Chapter 3. The Cloud of Unknowing. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. Hakuin Zenji, Song of Zazen, translated by Robert Aitken. The five ascetics are gathered around the shattered stump of a felled tree. As the sun climbs higher in the sky above the park, the heat becomes almost unbearable. Even the air burns in the nose and throat, bitter with smoke drifting from dozens of sacrificial fires. One of the five sits cross-legged in the red dust, trying to meditate, wedged upright among the rudder-like roots of the felled tree, while the others are sitting on freshly cut logs that the woodcutter left scattered about the jagged stump. They stare listlessly at the ground or up at the burning sky. Their garments are a motley patchwork stitched together from scraps of cloth, tree bark, and the wings of dead birds. They seem oblivious to the flies, or perhaps they have simply chosen to endure them. An atmosphere of sadness and defeat hangs about the heads of the five emaciated men living rough in the deer park at Isipatana, about 6 miles northeast of Varanasi. One of them is much older than the others. This is Kondanya, one of 8 Brahmins summoned to King Suddhodana's court some 30 years earlier, and the only one who predicted unequivocally that he would become a Buddha. He must now be feeling the sting of his former teacher's failure even more keenly than these others. Badiya, Vapa, Mahanama, Asaji, all sons of Brahmins who went to the palace all those years ago to bestow their blessings and pay their respects. Like Kondanya, they have given up families, comfortable homes, and safe careers in the hereditary priesthood to walk this austere path, which has led nowhere. Nobody invented meditation. The chances are that for tens of thousands of years, humans everywhere have been sinking unawares into this altered state of consciousness. All it takes to evoke the relaxation response, the gateway to all forms of meditation, is to focus exclusively on a repetitive stimulus or movement long enough to break the stream of ordinary thought. In our deep prehistoric past, hunter-gatherers staring into the flames of their fires may have fallen into a meditative state, found the experience profoundly calming, and learned to do it at will. That was probably one of the earliest human meditative experiences, says John Kabat-Zinn. Anyone who has ever sat around a fire at night in the wilderness will know that after a while the talk dies down and everyone winds up gazing into the flames. Very quiet, very still, very awake, very focused. Kabat-Zinn began attending meditation retreats in 1965 at the age of 21, and while continuing to pursue his studies as a molecular biologist at MIT, trained under teachers including Philip Kaplow, author of The Three Pillars of Zen, and Korean Zen master Seung Sam. Meditation nurtured something in me that I've been looking for my whole life, he tells me. It was not only a compliment to my scientific and intellectual development, it was also deeply satisfying on a personal level. He doesn't view it as an inherently religious or mystical practice, however, simply as a way to cultivate wisdom through greater awareness and acceptance of what is happening from moment to moment. We're not talking about some special magical state, he says. We're talking about pure awareness. Of course, the idea that hunter-gatherers meditated is speculative, just as we'll never know for sure when humans developed language or a sense of humour. Unlike walking upright or hunting, for example, meditation hasn't left any traces in the prehistoric record. There are no telltale fossils or tools. The subjects of the evocative cave art created by our ancestors were almost always animals, and in the rare instances where people have been depicted, they are usually hunting them. So there's no way to know when meditation became formalized as a part of religious or shamanistic ritual. The oldest physical evidence that people had learned to meditate doesn't appear for tens of thousands of years after the debut of anatomically modern humans in the fossil record, some 200,000 years ago. It comes in the form of a carved stone seal, dated to around 2500 BCE, found among the archaeological remains of Mohenjo-Daro, one of the largest cities of the Indus Valley civilization, in what is now the Sindh province of Pakistan. The seal, which may well have been used as a stamp of priestly authority, depicts a seated godlike figure wearing a tall headdress made from a pair of buffalo horns. He is sitting on a dais in a recognizable yoga position, legs bent double with the heels of his feet together, his arms outstretched with the hands resting on his knees. At his sides are four animals, an elephant, a rhinoceros, a buffalo, and a tiger, and beneath the dais on which he sits are two antelope or ibex. Some archaeologists have claimed the seated figure is the Vedic god Rudra, a forerunner of the Hindu deity Shiva, sometimes depicted as an omniscient yogi, though this interpretation has been contested. God or human, he appears to be meditating. The earliest written references to meditative practices are found in the most ancient of all Indian scriptures, known as the Vedas, which date back to around 1500 BCE. With more detailed guidance provided much later in the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Yoga Sutras. These describe the classic yogic discipline known as pranava, which involves the constant repetition with each breath of Om, the first or ultimate sound that is said to have brought the whole world into existence. Repeating this mantra is supposed to help the meditator transcend suffering by uniting Atman, his or her true self or soul, with Brahman, the absolute reality or universal consciousness. In India's pre-Hindu Vedic religion, Brahman was the spiritual force the priests were said to channel through their animal sacrifices and chants, which may explain why they would later come to be known as Brahmins. In the classic of Hindu literature, the Bhagavad Gita, a fictional dialogue between the deity Krishna and his disciple Prince Arjuna, written as early as the 5th or 4th century BCE, Krishna provides what may be the first meditation self-help guide. Those who aspire to the state of yoga should seek the self in inner solitude through meditation. With body and mind controlled, they should constantly practice one-pointedness, free from expectations and from attachment to material possessions. Select a clean spot, neither too high nor too low, and seat yourself firmly on a cloth, a deerskin, and kusha grass. Then, once seated, strive to still your thoughts. Make your mind one-pointed in meditation, and your heart will be purified. Hold your body, head, and neck firmly in a straight line and keep your eyes from wandering. With all fears dissolved in the peace of the self, and all actions dedicated to Brahman, controlling the mind and fixing it on me, sit in meditation with me as your only goal. With senses and mind constantly controlled through meditation, united with the self within, an aspirant attains nirvana, the state of abiding joy and peace in me. In the Yoga Sutras compiled by Patanjali in the 4th century CE, some of the more concrete benefits of repeating the word Om are outlined. Mental pain, despair, nervousness, and agitation are the symptoms of a distracted condition of mind. For removing these obstacles, there should be the constant practice of the one principle, the repetition and cultivation of Om. Transcendental meditation, with its personalized mantras, is the direct descendant of this practice, and clearly works on the same principle. You could also argue that when Herbert Benson formulated his simple instructions for eliciting the relaxation response, he was simply replacing Om with One. His research had revealed that sitting in a quiet place with your eyes closed, silently repeating a word of one syllable for about 20 minutes, broke the train of regular thought, and in the process lowered blood pressure, slowed heart rate and breathing, and elicited a profound sense of calm. Benson argues that regardless of whether it is Om, One, or a more elaborate mantra, stripped of the religious language, what remains is a way to evoke the physiological flip side of the fight-or-flight response, an antidote to the stresses of everyday life. Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest monk who brought this Buddhist tradition to the West in the 1970s, recommended using the word Buddho, knowing or conscious awareness, for this purpose. He explained it in a talk to newly ordained monks in 1978. Just keep breathing in and out like this. Don't be interested in anything else. It doesn't matter even if someone is standing on their head with their ass in the air. Don't pay it any attention. Just stay with the in-breath and the out-breath. Bud on the in-breath, Do on the out-breath. Just stay with the breath in this way until you are aware of the in-breath and aware of the out-breath. Be aware in this way until the mind is peaceful, without irritation, without agitation, merely the breath going out and coming in. Meditative practices have played an important but less well-known role in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. In his guidebook for Christian contemplatives, The Cloud of Unknowing, an anonymous 14th century mystic claimed that during meditation, the soul is made one with God. This union was seen as the highest achievement of which human beings are capable. The author, probably an English Carthusian monk, wrote that before the fall, humans were closer to God as a result of meditation. This is the work in which humanity would have continued if we had never sinned, and it is the work for which we were made, and everything was made for us to help and further us in it, and by it we shall once more be restored. He conceded that a Christian could worship God by performing charitable works, but he was clearly convinced that a life of contemplation would bring him closer to his Maker. This is the work of the soul that pleases God most. All the saints and angels rejoice in this work and hasten to help it with all their might. All the devils are driven crazy when you do this, and try to frustrate it in all ways they can. The monk wrote that the work of contemplation was like entering a cloud of unknowing between the meditator and God that could not be penetrated by reason. You had to do your best to stay in this dark cloud for as long as you could. For if you are ever to feel or see him so far as it is possible in this life, it must always be in this cloud and this darkness. Christian monks, nuns, and hermits would cut themselves off from the outside world to devote themselves to attaining this mystical union of the soul with God. And they did so in a manner that would be perfectly familiar to a yogi trying to realize the unity of his true self, Atman, and the universal consciousness of Brahman. It was hard work for a Christian contemplative and not helped by all those devils, but there were tricks and wiles and secret stratagems of spiritual technique that could help suppress your mundane everyday thoughts. In accord with Benson's guidelines for eliciting the relaxation response, the author of The Cloud of Unknowing recommended an attitude of impassive acceptance toward distracting thoughts. One should not engage with them emotionally. Another of the monk stratagems echoed in many descriptions of meditation in different religious traditions involved a word that the contemplative must repeat over and over, but without making any attempt to investigate its meaning. Take only a short word of one syllable. That is better than one of two syllables, for the shorter it is, the better it agrees with the work of the Spirit. A word of this kind is the word God or the word love. Choose whichever you wish, or another, as you please, whichever you prefer of one syllable, and fasten this word to your heart, so that it never parts from it, whatever happens. This word is to be your shield and spear, whether you ride in peace or in war. With this word, you are to beat on the cloud and the darkness above you. With this word, you are to hammer down every kind of thought beneath the cloud of forgetting. So if any thought forces itself on you to ask what you would have, answer it with no more than this one word. And if, in its greatest learning, it offers to expound that word and tell you its attributes, say that you wish to have it quite whole, and not analyzed or explained. Francisco de Osuna, a 16th-century Spanish Franciscan friar, recommended in the Third Spiritual Alphabet that Christian contemplatives rebuff distracting thoughts with an emphatic no. He too advised against intellectual analysis. I warn you against discussing the matter further in your mind. It would greatly disturb your recollection. To examine into the matter would be a hindrance. Therefore, shut the door with no. You will know that the Lord will come and enter your soul if the doors, which are your senses, are closed. But you will answer that it would be wrong to say no to God, and he alone is expected. But God comes in some other way, of which you know nothing. Anyone who has meditated, whether or not they believe in a supernatural authority, will relate to the description in The Cloud of Unknowing of brief moments of transcendence in which our consciousness springs swiftly to God like a spark from a coal. Or how once in a while we may even forget the whole created world suddenly and completely before the gravitational pull of some thought or recollection brings us back to earth. But what of that, muses the anonymous writer? For straight afterwards it rises again as suddenly as it did before. These spiritual experiences could be surprisingly pleasant, he says, and to a modern reader some of his descriptions sound almost trippy. As a foretaste of the heavenly reward, God would sometimes set aflame the body of a devout servant of his here in this life with most wonderful sensations of sweetness and pleasure. Some of these do not come into the body from outside through the windows of our senses, but from inside, rising and springing from abundance of spiritual joy and from true devotion in spirit. He tells his readers that they shouldn't feel guilty about these heavenly sensations. Such experience certainly cannot be evil if the deceptions of intellectual ingenuity and of uncontrolled straining of the bodily heart are removed, as I am teaching you, or, in a better way, if you know one. This has distinct echoes of Siddhartha's musings on the pleasurable state of mind he experienced during his childhood meditation experience. Why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality, nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities? This was the middle way between harsh self-denial and sensory indulgence that he wished to explore, much to the disgust of his fellow ascetics. There are other clear parallels between Christian and Buddhist meditation. A Christian contemplative will often call to mind the suffering of Christ on the cross, just as Buddhist monks and nuns sometimes meditate on the suffering of humans and other beings to cultivate compassion, considered an essential component of enlightenment. The creatures writhing in the wake of King Suddhodana's plough are reputed to have evoked compassion in the heart of his son. And in a passage that to all intents and purposes is a call for greater mindfulness, the author of The Cloud of Unknowing encourages his readers to take good care of time and how you spend it, for nothing is more precious than time. In one little time, however little it is, heaven may be won or lost. Cultivating awareness of the present moment, the cutting edge of experience, is also an aim of meditation in Jainism, which predated Buddhism in ancient India. The breath is often used as a focus of attention in Jain meditation and many other religious traditions. In Judaism, to provide conditions favorable for prophecy and union with God, 13th century Kabbalist Abraham Abulafia recommended reciting the letters of holy names in Hebrew in a particular order. To unseal the soul, to untie the knots which bind it, in conjunction with specific breathing rhythms and bodily postures. Gershom Scholem, a 20th century Israeli philosopher and historian, found the similarity with Indian contemplative practices so striking, he even went so far as to say Abulafia's teachings represent but a Judaized version of that ancient spiritual technique which has found its classical expression in the practices of the Indian mystics who followed the system known as yoga. One might think meditation had gone out of fashion in world religions other than Buddhism and Hinduism, but in recent years there has been something of a revival in Christian contemplative practice dating back to the Desert Fathers, known as centering prayer, which often involves repetition of the Jesus prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Or a single, sacred word. And it's worth pointing out that the line between prayer and contemplation can be blurry. How does saying Hail Mary, full of grace, 50 times, for example, differ from the dogged repetition of a mantra? The words of the Hail Mary have a religious significance, whereas a mantra need not mean anything. But after a few dozen repetitions, how deeply is one really thinking about the Blessed Virgin? What is certain is that repetition clears a space in the mind by warding off stray thoughts. The same will apply whether one is repeating Om, One, No, Adoramus Te Domine, or Hare Krishna. In Roman Catholicism, fingering the beads of a rosary, one for each Hail Mary, helps sharpen the attention still further. Prayer beads are also employed in Sufism, the wisdom tradition of Islam. Sufis use them during a contemplative practice known as dhikr to keep track of repetitions of certain phrases or the names of God for the purposes of spiritual purification and to attain union with the divine. One result, though not the immediate objective, is to foster greater psychological well-being by enhancing moment-to-moment awareness and transcending the everyday self. 11th century Persian mystic Al-Ghazali says of dhikr, "Let him reduce his heart to a state in which the existence of anything and its non-existence are the same to him. Then let him sit alone in some corner, limiting his religious duties to what is absolutely necessary, and not occupying himself either with reciting the Quran or considering its meaning, or with books of religious traditions, or with anything of the sort. And let him see to it that nothing save God Most High enters his mind. Then, as he sits in solitude, let him not cease saying continuously with his tongue, 'Allah, Allah,' keeping his thought on it. He has now laid himself bare to the breathings of that mercy, and nothing remains but to await what God will open to him, as God has done after this manner to prophets and saints. If he follows the above course, he may be sure that the light of the real, ultimate reality or God will shine out in his heart. At first unstable, like a flash of lightning, it turns and returns, though sometimes it hangs back. And if it returns, sometimes it abides, and sometimes it is momentary. And if it abides, sometimes its abiding is long, and sometimes short." After the establishment of settled Muslim communities in India in the 12th century CE, the subcontinent became a melting pot for the wisdom traditions of Sufism, Jainism, Hinduism, and Buddhism. Some of the meditative practices that emerged probably spread much further afield, perhaps even colouring some strands of Kabbalah in Judaism and the Christian monastic tradition in early 13th century Europe. But one of the common threads that runs through all these spiritual traditions is their use of focused attention to transcend the ordinary self and other barriers to experiencing ultimate reality. Another common element is the discipline required to overcome the natural urges of body and mind. Buddhists identify 5 hindrances that obstruct successful meditation: sensual desire, ill will, sleepiness, overexcitement or depression, and doubt. While a monastic with a personality dominated by ill will would be advised to meditate on loving kindness, compassion, or sympathetic joy, one easily swayed by sensual desire would meditate on the ugliness of the body in its 10 stages of putrefaction: bloated, livid, festering, cut up, gnawed, scattered, hacked and scattered, bleeding, worm-infested, and skeletal. For contemplatives with a tendency to intellectualize, which would probably include people who read books about the science of enlightenment, mindfulness of breathing is strongly recommended. Over hundreds of years, some Buddhist traditions have developed highly involved esoteric techniques for establishing the mental calm that is the prerequisite for insight, meditation, and realizing the true nature of reality. The Tibetan system, known as Mahamudra, specifies 21 meditative practices that must be carried out in sequence to focus the attention to an increasingly fine degree. Early sessions involve simple exercises such as focusing on a pebble or a twig, visualizing the syllable hum, or following the breath. Later sessions start to train the meditator to deal with thoughts as they arise, first learning how to suspend them completely, but later learning how to simply observe them, not cutting them off at all, yet not falling under their spell. Each practice introduces a new image to express the increasingly subtle refinements of attention that are required. For example, in practice 15, you will keep your mind as if you were spinning a thread, keeping an even tension on it, for if your contemplation is too tight, then it snaps, and if it is too loose, then you slip into indolence. In practice 17, if visual images pop into your consciousness, you try to keep your mind as if it were a child looking at the murals painted on a temple wall. You must neither enjoy them nor fear them, and thus neither think they are important nor cling to them. By practice 18, the way you deal with thoughts as they arise has become spontaneous, effortless, and your mind is like an elephant being pricked by a pin. You feel your thoughts occur, but you yourself never cut them off nor react to them.